welcome to our second episode of Synversations, a podcast that explores the depths of synthetic biology from various multidisciplinary standpoints. I'm Devaki, and I will be your host for today, and I'm a second-year life sciences student. So Synversations is a five-episode-long podcast created by the University of Toronto Policy and Practices Division of its iGEM team. iGEM is a student association dedicated to the practice of synthetic biology and dissemination of its scientific foundations. In today's episode, we'll be exploring how bioethics plays a major role in synthetic biology. Joining us today is Este and Kat.
Hi, I'm Este, and I'm a third-year student in bioethics and ethics, society, and law.
Hi, I'm Kat, and I'm a fifth-year student in molecular genetics and immunology.
In its most simplest terms, CRISPR is an innate system that naturally protects bacteria from viruses by using its stored DNA sequence to match and cut any viral DNA. If we give the cell a DNA sequence to repair the damage, it will incorporate the new sequence into its own DNA. If these changes are made to the eggs or sperm, the new traits will be passed on to future generations. In this case, the offsprings have a 50% chance of inheriting a new trait. However, gene drives defy this rule of inheritance by increasing this rate to nearly 100%. The introduced trait will then get passed on to all future generations. This technique works in organisms that reproduce sexually and can make a significant breakthrough in agriculture and disease control. That is, putting a stop to malaria or increase crop yields. This tool is incredibly powerful as it can change the course of evolution.
Okay, so why are gene drives so important today?
Well, I think one of the reasons why gene drives have become such a topic of discussion is because of certain, primarily I think because of the Zika virus outbreak is one of the reasons why it has been brought up more, but other things, other major illnesses that can be spread by mosquitoes like malaria and dengue and sleeping sickness, I think.
Yeah, people are really interested in the capacity to cure, get rid of diseases, it mm-hmm. sounds like. So it's becoming more prevalent now as we're more capable in being able to, and in different areas of like gene editing and stuff like that. But also, we have been discussing before that it's been around, the idea of gene drives has been around for many years, right? Even mm-hmm. occurring naturally.
Yeah, there are certain genes that are like selfish genes, in the sense that, like you were saying, that generally genes or traits have a 50-50% chance of being inherited by the offspring, but there are certain genes that have a slight bias towards being inherited, so selfish genes. So those have existed naturally before the advent of gene drives became something, or a tool or a technique that we can actually apply to solve problems. And I think another reason why gene drives have become so prevalent, or the thought of using gene drives has become so prevalent, is with the advent of the CRISPR revolution, because now we can use the CRISPR-Cas system to engineer gene drives really efficiently.
Yeah, and basically the idea, I guess back to the question, just the idea that we have the capability, or coming to the capability, of being able to cure diseases mm-hmm. and get rid of invasive species that harm, or we think to harm the ecosystem, mm-hmm. along with the issues that come with that, but that would be the main reason why.
Counter gene drives. Basically, the idea of resistance emerging to gene drives. And so what they've also tracked not only is the spread of the gene, or the activity of the gene drive within the population, but also the emergence of resistance. Because if you have a fluorescent marker, right, you can just shine a light on your fruit flies and they'll basically fluoresce red, and you'll know if your gene drive is working. But also, if you monitor them over time, the loss of that fluorescence protein would then indicate the emergence of resistance, which is something that is also a very interesting topic when you're talking about gene drives, is that if it works, that's great, but then how long will it work? Because, you know, as you know, evolution, we can't really control evolution over long periods of time. We can do gene drives, which are short-term changes that can be quite drastic, but then over time,
is the idea you're kind of getting at that they could outgrow the gene?
Yeah, sort of, in the sense that, yeah, like over populations, what might happen is that there might be some sort of pressure, selective pressure against the gene drive, and we can study it and try and identify it and then try and change our gene drive, but we can't stop that process of resistance.
Yeah. So maybe let's start by looking at the benefits and the harms of gene drives can have. So let's start off with the benefits. What do you think can be achieved through the use of gene drives? How can this be beneficial?
Well, I think if we look at like the two different types of gene drives that they have replacement gene drives where you can basically modify your vector, such as a mosquito, so that it can no longer carry whatever disease agent you're looking at, whether it be like malaria or Zika. And then you also have like the suppression gene drives, which basically engineer your vector so that over a period of time, they will eventually die or become extinct. So, I mean, either one of those, like the benefit is that ultimately you can possibly prevent people from acquiring an illness that seriously impacts their life.
Yeah, so, I mean, curing diseases, illnesses definitely would be one main benefit that people are trying to look at, as well as also increasing crop yields in some cases, which is great if you, in terms of in reducing famine and basically being able to produce better crops and more consistent crops, reducing or stopping famine would
yeah.
be the ideal.
It's interesting because like when I think of it, like gene drives in mosquitoes and gene drives in like agricultural plants, somehow like the idea has, there's like different associations that I make with like certain things, like with a mosquito gene drive, to me it feels more isolated.
Yeah,
if that makes
sense.
How
so?
Like you're engineering one, I'm not sure how specific. Generally, like gene drives, like the idea of gene hopping from one organism to the other, you design, like it's a design consideration. You can avoid it to some extent and you can put safeguard mechanisms to make sure that your gene drive is isolated to a system.
Mm-hmm.
And mosquitoes to some extent, at least to me, feel like an isolated, they're part of an ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
sure, but they're more removed, whereas I feel like a crop plant.
You mean it would spread more sporadically?
Not that it would spread sporadically, but if you make a crop plant, perhaps grow more efficiently. The idea of like gene drives for invasive species,
mm-hmm.
like you might engineer an invasive species out of a crop plant,
okay.
if that makes sense. If you make it grow better.
Okay.
But for me,
it seems like they would probably honestly be similar.
So what kind of problems do you think we'll face if this happens?
Like technical or in terms of like implementing?
Let's start with technical.
I mean, technical, I guess we've sort of addressed the problem of like the emergence of resistance in the sense that you can engineer a gene drive, but you cannot ensure that it will be selected for continuously through multiple generations. And as a short term, it can spread in a population, but then as we have learned, life finds a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
quote Macmillan quoting someone else.
Yeah.
But yeah, life finds a way. And
so you mean in terms, is this back to that eventually they could outgrow the gene drive,
yeah,
and
yeah.
like, evolve out of it?
Yeah. But I think like another problem would be that say if you were to engineer a gene drive that were to make a species less competitive or less dominant, so to speak, in a population, or maybe to engineer it for extinction, you have that problem of, first of all, you're removing an organism from an ecosystem that functions as a whole,
mm-hmm.
so you're disrupting a system, but also on another level, what would happen once the system tries to mend itself? So how would the system try and reach like an equilibrium again? So specifically looking at like mosquitoes, the specific mosquito vector that has been used or has been looked at as like the Aedes aegypti mosquito that transmits malaria and I think Zika more readily.
Because I mean, it seems that if we eradicate the mosquito altogether of one type of it, then it kind of gets sort of the problem of, well, they might grow out of the gene
yeah.
because they wouldn't exist anymore. But then there is the problem of, well, other mosquitoes might learn to or begin to take over the role of delivering malaria,
mm-hmm.
like a pretty package to someone.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's definitely that. And other harms, I mean,
loss of biodiversity.
Yeah,
yeah.
Loss of biodiversity.
I mean, the main question is, I mean, everyone hates mosquitoes, or at least most people, but no one
loves mosquitoes. I want to meet this person and have a serious conversation with them.
But we don't know what role mosquitoes truly have in the ecosystem. And I mean, no one, obviously they are food,
mm-hmm.
and we don't know to what extent other species would be able to survive without mosquitoes. So bats eat mosquitoes, frogs eat mosquitoes, you know, all these different species rely on them as food. And while I used to think when I was younger that, like, oh my god, they can eat so many other things, like, but if, I mean, we don't know that, you
yeah.
know, if an entire species is gone and that's their main source of food, well, that can diminish the presence of bats, you know,
mm-hmm.
or you find, it's the same thing that happens when you introduce a new species into an
exactly.
unfamiliar territory. It can, like, expand and decimate other populations, just
mm-hmm.
as when you take it away.
Yeah, and it's really hard to sort of predict that. And I think the Cornell University, they tried to build, like, a mathematical model to try and understand what would happen. And to some extent, you can try and model what might happen, but there are just things you can't account for in that model, because there's
mm-hmm.
so many variables. And like...
And nature is very unpredictable.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, I mean, you can try and, rationally design out what... the outcomes, but at the end of the day, you don't really know
mm-hmm.
until
and
you try it.
There is the whole idea that you want to, I mean, that's a risk that you take,
mm-hmm.
and you want to think about the fact, like, is it worth it? I mean, of course we don't want to let people continue to get malaria and
dengue
fever. You don't want those to continue. So is it worth the risk that we could harm the ecosystem greatly, potentially?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to say. And while it seems like it of course is a horrible thing to keep these diseases around, they're also in some ways a part of nature. So I'm not to say that we should allow people to just be sick,
mm-hmm.
but it's to say that it is in some ways nature communicating what it's trying to do. So mosquitoes transmit diseases, and we have evolved to the point where we can evolution.
Yeah.
We have evolved, you know.
This
is our new ability. It's like the sheep or the gazelle run away from the lion. This is just us attempting to run away from the
mm-hmm.
disease spreading mosquitoes. But there is something that is quite unsettling
mm-hmm.
about the idea that we can completely control
mm-hmm.
nature in
mm-hmm.
its whole,
and they feel that sort of guilt. Perhaps could that be one of the reasons why people are kind of against the notion?
Well, there's the idea that, like, what right do we have to get rid of a species?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
why are we better than the species we're trying to get rid of?
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
In terms of, like, so if we ignore the notion of, like, this is our evolutionary whatever,
yeah.
we've evolved to be able to get rid of them, what right do we do we have? And I don't think there's any, like, there's no natural process,
yeah.
not that I know of, maybe you know of, that would willingly, like, just or knowingly get rid of an entire species. Like, it's a race, you know, and it's competition.
Yeah, I mean, other than, like, things like disease,
yeah.
and, like, natural disasters, which do just eliminate
yeah.
entire populations, which are kind of unpredictable forces of nature, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
There are no, like, I think, like, this approach is very, like, it's very planned out.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, like, there's a lot of thought put into it. And it's, like, systematically designing a method in which to get rid of another species would be, if we're talking about gene drives to, like, eradicate species. It's very thought out. Like,
yeah.
if we were to put it into, like, the legal system, it's like first degree murder.
Yeah.
In the sense that you have the intent and you thought about it. It's premeditated.
Yeah.
Not to say that it's murder, necessarily. But
I mean, there's the idea that you could argue,
you could argue that it is murder if you go down that line, right?
Well, I mean, there's the concern that it's like, what right do we have to, why is it such that we should be able to kill an entire species so that other humans don't get diseases.
Mm-hmm.
This is not to like get into
yeah.
a whole thing on animal testing, but it's the idea that like humans are better,
mm-hmm.
Which is, can be concerning. And the humans are better, so we should test on animals. Humans are better, you know, so
yeah.
everything we do should be, it's okay that we do all these things to animals or other species, you know, so for the safety and security of humans. It is difficult sometimes to argue that for mosquitoes because they're not self-aware, they don't really have...
How do we know they're not self-aware?
Yeah, that was the question I was going to ask.
Yeah, so I guess we don't. But they are very, very instinctual
mm-hmm.
beings, you know, they go based off of, they have a goal, you know,
yeah.
they eat, they breed, basically,
yeah.
you know, and... There and but even imagine if it wasn't a mosquito, if it was, you know, a certain type of like gopher that transmitted diseases that to the same extent that mosquitoes did, or if it was, draw the lines in different places.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally have trouble drawing the line necessarily at like certain like markers because it becomes difficult to. Well, what is the point in which a being is equal to us?
Mm-hmm.
And we could extend it, and some people do extend it, to ecosystems,
yeah.
in that we have no right to put our own personal welfare above, like, the ecosystem. So you can reasonably
mm-hmm.
argue that an ecosystem has as much of a right to exist and, you know, to survive as we do. And to disrupt it completely, I mean, well, it's not good for us, but it's not good for the ecosystem, it's not good for the animals in it. And if we inadvertently harm a
mm-hmm.
whole, like, ecosystem, a whole species, it troubles me, and a lot of other thinkers, to what extent, like, we put human lives first, is kind of what
that
I'm getting
sense.
At.
Yeah.
But at the same time, don't want malaria.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because if you look at it from, like, you mentioned this earlier, how if you look at it from an evolutionary, like, standpoint, the basic goals of any kind of species is to survive and reproduce, and anything that prevents us from doing so is something that we need to, like, stop. Right?
Yeah,
like,
and
you
I think
were talking about this
it's
earlier.
Sort of like a basic animal need, if we were to go down to, like, our instinctual level, is to reproduce and to survive. And anything that starts to get into the way of that, we as a species will start to try and problem solve and figure out how to get around that.
That was
it's a loaded
yeah.
loaded issue for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
That was a nice discussion though.
Do we want to talk about one thing that I kind of wanted to maybe bring up?
I had something in mind.
Yeah,
that.
There was something that was bum bum bum. Oh. What if wrong people get access to gene drives?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right,
yeah.
The terrace and stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 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 the terrace. Let's talk about the terrace.
So, should I just ask you a question? Okay, so what if the wrong people, what if this falls into the wrong hands? You know, what,
yeah.
Let's try
so,
to
so
imagine
about,
that kind of scenario.
So should we talk first about like the likelihood that it falls into the wrong hands?
Like they're very accessible, is what you.
It is and it isn't in the sense that an article in Science, basically that addressed how to work with gene drive safely, and one of their principles was to always have like two stringent confinement strategies when you're engineering a gene drive. And also when like, I think I'm blabbering on a little bit, but basically it's from like an iGEM team perspective, I think there was a lot of drama, or not drama, there was a lot of press about like a college team potentially engineering a gene drive, but it really wasn't,
mm-hmm.
that necessarily. They were,
people
they
were
had,
concerned about like them releasing
yeah,
some large
like,
mosquito.
Yeah, to them it seemed very accessible, like a college mm-hmm. team, but they actually had advisors, and iGEM actually was monitoring kind of what they were doing from a certain distance, and making sure that they weren't doing things that were dangerous. But then we get into like community labs, like DIY biohacker community.
What are those things, by the way?
So basically, to kind of oversimplify it, It's people who don't necessarily have a science background, or maybe people who don't have institutional access to a lab, who within their community want to get their hands dirty with like biology and synthetic biology, and to sort of try and engineer some kinds of applications for their community. So there are little communities, like community labs, where people can do synthetic biology to some extent. And I guess what people were worried about with like the iGEM team and Gene Drives is that if a community college team can do it, why can't a community lab or DIY bio lab kind of get access to this gene drive? And what happens if they do, and what happens if it gets out? Like, sort of the thought spiral of if
it becomes a more regular present technology, then do you think perhaps it is more likely that people could have access to it in a less regulated or more regulated manner, but maybe it's more available, so potentially more people will be going after it?
So I can see there being like, maybe say if you were to release engineered organisms into the environment, like say if you were to engineer gene drives in mosquitoes and you release those mosquitoes into the wild, technically those mosquitoes that have the gene drive or like the engineered sort of genes are out there.
You need some sort of world agreement and a multi-nation agreement that has regulations on them, on these technologies, which is, as we've seen in the past, can be very difficult to regulate. It's very difficult to get nations to agree on multiple things.
Yeah, and I think something that was brought up was that even if every single nation agrees to some unified policy, what happens if one nation decides to go against that?
Yeah, exactly. Because every nation has, a lot of the time, their own interests and world interests, but mainly their own interests at heart, you know? So as you can see, even with like the Paris climate, which took a very long time to get most nations to agree to it, and even now, one nation can decide not to participate. And while that's a very different subject in terms of like climate change and gene drives, if one nation decides, oh, I don't want these regulations, or they're not good for our country, then that can affect the whole safety of these regulations that would be in place. I mean, they would be there for a reason, even if it was the most basic of regulations, which is concerning.
Yeah, it is concerning. Another, going back to what you said about like nations having their own interests, there's also a problem with like commercial interests getting in the way. Like, say if maybe engineering a gene drive to cause a certain species to go extinct can help increase the crop yields of some certain company or increase product yields, then you can see there being a lot of like conflicts of interests.
Yeah, there's concerns when you try and commercialize everything and every piece of science, and especially when it comes to like the health of people, and when you involve money, it becomes very
tricky.
Yeah, tricky. And you know, even potentially like when you see, I don't know if there was some way to manufacture certain, you would, or some kind of like drug resistant, or you know, some kind of
like
enhanced drug. I don't know how that would play in.
An anti-malarial drug or something.
If there was, if gene drives played into kind of this commercialization and drug manufacturing, I don't know if it
like,
would at all.
Like, you mean into, like if you could start to tie gene drives with like big pharma?
Yeah, this might be a big leap, and it probably is. But you know, in the concern about commercialization and.
I think, although Big Pharma right now is like, it's Big Pharma, but we can see other industries with the power of gene drives rising to some like equal sort of power status.
Yeah.
And I think that is one concern that people have, and like rightly so, is that it gets tricky the more
money is involved.
Yeah.
And personal interests play a role.
Well, folks, that's all for our bioethics episode. This episode was a sneak peek into some of the questions we will be exploring as a team. So keep up with our progress in the upcoming months as we talk to people with various perspectives on the issue. And don't forget to check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and igemtoronto.ca. Stay tuned for our next episode as we explore the roles of engineering in synthetic biology.